officer, that was the first time I ever saw the customer high-pressure the salesman. Somebody chasing her?
I better have a look at those papers, Charlie.
She looked like a wrong one to you?
Acted like one.
The only funny thing, she paid me $700 in cash.
I have...
Current geek!
Everybody, and welcome to the weekly proceedings of the Meeks of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world they need to keep it current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson with Tom Merritt.
Yes, sir. This is a Current Geek Film Fest episode, a chance for two geeks to take the time to watch the greatest movies of all time and discuss our impressions from a geeky perspective. Now, we're not film critics, we're not scholars, and we don't claim to give you the comprehensive expert evaluation of these films, but... if you'd like to have a friendly conversation about great movies, you come to the right place.
That's right. And we have made our way all the way to Psycho. Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, 1960 is the year. We're not talking about the Gus Van Sant redo deal.
No, we're not talking about Psychos 2, 3, or 4.
No.
That also starred Anthony Perkins.
Those were all bad, very bad movies. I don't mind him cashing in on his success. I think that's great. These were bad sequels.
It was Universal cashing in on the success as well, not just Anthony Perkins. Also, Psycho 2 starred Vera Miles, who plays Lila Crane in Hitchcock's Psycho.
Oh, my Lord. I had no idea. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, see, look at all the information we already have about the film Psycho. And as far as just quick rules, we don't kind of arbitrarily just say, what are cool movies in the past? We have a kind of an amalgamated list that Tom's put together from various lists. And we've worked our way through a number of them. Those include Godfather and Casablanca and others. And now we come to the horror genre, which we haven't tackled here and is also kind of a rarity for anyone's top 200 movie list, as far as I'm concerned. Can you think of any other horror movies outside of this? Maybe.
That's a good question. Let me open up.
We should look.
My spreadsheet here, because what I did, if you probably heard me say this before, if you've listened to one of these episodes, but I took Rotten Tomatoes, the American Film Institute, and IMDb, and I just kind of combined their top lists to create an Uber list.
Yeah.
Rear Window. It's a Hitchcock movie. I don't think it's a horror movie.
Yeah. More psychological
Singing
thriller.
Singing in the Rain, if you don't like music, maybe, but it's not really a horror movie. Dr. Strangelove, not really a horror movie.
Well, and maybe...
North by Northwest against Hitchcock.
Sure, but maybe I'm miscategorizing it, because it's not so much horror as it is suspense and thriller kind of stuff. The horror,
well, and that's the thing. Like, I keep seeing Hitchcock movies on here, and I'm like, well, it's kind of like that, but Psycho does cross into the horror genre.
I would agree.
And in fact, that's why they made Psycho 2, 3, and 4 in the 80s, is once the rights reverted to them, they're like, yeah, we could turn this into the next Halloween, right?
Sure.
We could just have Norman Bates forever. Except the great thing about Freddy Krueger and Halloween is you've got people in masks or makeup, so you don't, if the actor dies, it's fine.
Yeah.
Anthony Perkins, he never had any kids.
No.
Norman Bates didn't.
No. And he also died a little young, died at age 60, which is kind of a bummer. I remember when he passed.
I mean, that's not really young, but it's young for now.
Yeah, relatively speaking. He's an interesting actor, and I'm going to get into this more as we talk about it in the episode, but...
Pulp Fiction, Alien, I'm still looking.
Alien, sure. Alien horror movie. For sure.
Yeah. It's sci-fi horror movie.
It is, but it's one by one. A killer is
Toy
picking
Story
off people.
Toy Story 3 horror movie?
Has moments.
Oh, Jaws. Jaws. There you go.
Okay, Jaws. We'll give Jaws.
I had to go all the way down to number 244.
So I've been excited to get back to this one because it's been forever. And I've seen both this and the remake at some point. I saw the remake years ago. I remember when I saw the original, I was probably in my early 20s, and I was impressed how a movie made in 1959 and released in 1960 held up as much as it did, because in my experience at that time, there weren't too many movies like that. We've been through this, how I kind of have a bias against black and white, old, my mom's movies, basically. But I kind of was starting to have a little bit of a turnaround, getting a little more cultured in that regard, and I'm happy to report I think the 1960 Psycho holds up in some really impressive ways that is still certain, some cheese laying around, little bits of cheese here and there, I think yeah. the death on the stairs is ridiculous with the private investigator. It's the dumbest thing ever.
Well, he's going for the same thing he did with Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, if you've ever seen that.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost looks a little cheesy in Vertigo, but because the movie's called Vertigo and the character has vertigo, you kind of go, oh, okay, this is showing me the feeling of vertigo. The guy falling down the stairs, it just looks, it looks a little weird.
It looks super stupid, but that's fine. We'll give it that. I think the shower scene remains.
Oh, it's
shocking, yeah. and horrifying, but at the same time, like this, it's weird. The movie could rely on that soundtrack, that weird music. They could rely on that a lot more than they do, because there are moments.
Well, and Hitchcock originally didn't want music in the shower scene. He just wanted it to be silent.
Mm.
And the guy who did the music, Bernard Herrmann, said, let me try some. Yeah. Let me see if you like it. Yeah. And Hitchcock's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Well, look how iconic it is now. It's like one of the most iconic scores ever. But he also kind of got his way a little bit, kind of halfway. So there's that music. Then the killing happens. She slumped over the thing, and now it's a lot of visual with nothing but the sound of a shower running on its own. Yeah. And it's super effective and creepy as crap. Like, it really got me in a way I didn't expect. But
it works even better with the music during the stabbing, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's when your brain would be freaking out, both as the killer and the killed, one would assume. Like, you know, full of energy and panic and emotions. And then when you're dead, you're dead. And if you're the killer and you're done with the killing, everything just calms.
Yeah.
One would assume. And I think that's what he was trying to get across, is the music is the panic of the moment. And then when it ends, you come back. And if you've ever been in a panic situation like that, hopefully not like that, but but if you've ever been in a real panic situation, there is that moment when you start to hear things again, right?
Yeah.
When you start to hear the mundane sounds and that water coming out of, down in the shower, is it definitely provides that. And I don't think he would have got that impact if he hadn't had the music.
Yeah, I agree. It's really something. Now, my just to back it up a little, my memory of this movie, even having seen it relatively not that long ago, it's been 10-15 years, but whatever the last time was, I always forget all about anything up to the hotel. I forgot about the money getting taken. I forget about her boss not knowing about it, or her seeing him in the street, or the cop, or any of that. I forget about all that stuff.
I do the opposite. I feel like the movie is everything leading up to the shower scene. Like, I remember the hotel scene. Mm. I remember her driving and trading in the car. And then I forget about everything that happened afterwards. Like, oh, right. He's in the town and he's not in Phoenix and they have to call. And I remember looking at it like, wow, we have like an hour left. What happens? Like, how does Norman get away with it this long? Mm-hmm. I, even though I've seen it several times, I saw it and I mentioned this film class that I took in college several times, but it was a really good film class because it showed us a lot of these movies and Psycho was one of them.
Yeah. And it's probably not surprising that scene, the shower and the murder and all that, is so iconic for this film that it for a lot of people it is the scene. It's the knife doing this, the music going reet, 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 and the
we haven't mentioned that there's some argument about this, but for the majority of it, you don't see a knife land.
Right.
And you certainly don't see blood.
No.
You don't until it's over.
Right.
And then you see the chocolate syrup going down the drain. But it is not a gory scene.
Right.
It is all in your mind. And that is one of the brilliances of Psycho, because I'll be honest, I feel like, unlike Casablanca, unlike Citizen Kane, unlike a couple of the other movies we've seen so far, mm-hmm. this one has weak spots, like mm-hmm. identifiably weak spots in the plot. Mm-hmm. That is not unusual for Hitchcock, though.
Yeah.
Hitchcock was not about plot.
No.
The money is a MacGuffin. You know that at the beginning, if you've ever studied Hitchcock at all, you're like, okay, it's not going to be about the money, even if you'd never seen Psycho. But this one, you know, there are some parts, like you say, where you're like kind of rolling your eyes, like, really? Would he really do that? But it is beautifully constructed for suspense, for tension, and for visuals.
Yeah.
And the shower scene is, of course, the pinnacle of those visuals.
For me, it was, there's a scene early on when they got way more gross about what somebody like this would be like for doing this in the secret, in the remake. And I have so much to say about why you'd make a remake of this movie, because I'm actually going to make an argument that you should never make a remake of Psycho. But anyway, There's a scene where he pulls the taxidermy off the wall and he's got that hole and he's staring at her while she's changing. There is a close-up of his eye and you've got soft foreground background elements and his eye in sharp focus. And it looks like something somebody filmed yesterday. It looks really, really cool and really creepy. And I don't remember it being that effective before. It wasn't some cheeseball zoom. It wasn't some poorly constructed Steadicam or any of that. It was just a really tight, well-made shot with no music, just silence and him being creepy. And it just establishes his character in a way that, you know, is meaningful for where they intend to take him.
Really well, and good. This is the problem with knowing Psycho as well as we do. I almost wish one of us had never seen it before, unfortunately, because a lot of what he does is misdirection. A lot of the beauty of the movie is lost after the first run through because he's making you think it's a heist, right? He's making you think she's stealing the money and is she going to get away with it? Then it's a, oh, wait a minute. It's not about her stealing the money. It's about him stealing the money from her. And then he looks through the window. Oh, it's not about him stealing the money. Just it's about him, you know, exploiting her. Mm-hmm. And at every turn, it's something else. And then it becomes, oh, it's not about him at all. It's about his mother, his secret mother killing her. And then you find out, yeah, I mean, I said secret mother, but you don't find out till later, like, wait a minute, is his mother still alive? And then it becomes a mystery about, oh, was there a conspiracy where his mother didn't die and he hid her? And then of course, you know, the hugest reveal at the end that all this time, he was his mother, and his mother was dead and he had her propped up in a corpse and he was wearing the dress and everything, but it is classic Hitchcock misdirection from beginning to end. Twist. It's not like I didn't enjoy that watching it again, but there's nothing like seeing that for the first time.
Yeah, there's a Sixth Sense quality to it, right? Like once you know the turns and the twists and the ideas, then you're like, oh, okay, I got it. And it can remain iconic and all that other stuff, but at the same time, a little bit of that shine is taken away because now you know. And I wondered as I was watching it again, I wondered how many people in 1960, which is well before we were born, were seeing this movie and didn't know that he was going to be basically Gollum from Lord of the Rings and have an inner voice that was talking to him when, you know, basically split personality. Did anybody really know that? Because I tried to do like you pretend I don't know anything about Star Wars kind of mode.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, all right, well, if I'm watching this for the first time, how am I perceiving the fact that these people in town said that, well, the mother's been dead, but then he's upstairs scooping up a lady who's arguing with him. And it's very smartly done where you never see him making the voice, which is what's happening.
Right.
And you see him carry her out of the room and start going down the stairs. I'm like, well, that's a real lady. Just banged her legs on the stairs. Like, if I didn't know better, I think I'd still think that, oh, no, his mom's there. There's some story about her being dead, but she's not really dead and all of this.
And there was a murder-suicide, right?
Right.
And so, like, oh, maybe they covered it up. Maybe, you know, maybe he killed his dad. And to cover it up, they pretended she was dead. Like, there's all kinds of things that would run through your head if you don't know how it's going
to
turn out.
Sure. And there just had to be somebody in the theater, though, that saw that and went, oh, well, that's obviously it's him. You know, but I did.
Yeah,
I
don't know my wife.
I don't think it would have been me. I think I would have bought into this.
I bought into it the first time I saw it. I didn't know.
Yeah,
I did not know. I knew about the shower scene.
Right.
So I knew Anthony Perkins was going to kill Janet Leigh. That was the thing I had been spoiled on. But I didn't know about him beating his mom.
Right.
That had not been spoiled for me. So that was fun. The first time that I saw it.
There's some pretty good trivia about how he thinks it's amazing that his entire life, this is some statement he made before he died, but his entire life, he was famous for this scene where he kills Janet Leigh in the shower, but the actual shot is not him.
Yeah.
It's some double. And it was shot in a different part of the country. It wasn't in California. It was in New York or something. And so he's forever known for this one moment that was not actually him.
That he didn't do.
Doing it, which I, you know, that's movies. We escape into them and forget about who's what.
And then there's the opposite controversy of people saying, well, Janet Leigh was never in the shower. Right. or Hitchcock didn't direct that scene.
Right.
That's another one that's out there.
Right.
And, you know, Janet Leigh's like, Oh, yeah. I was in that shower the whole time. That was not a body double. That was me. And Alfred was there. Yeah. I was there. And yeah. he was there. And we were all there.
We were all there.
Yeah.
Well, that also speaks to probably the quality of the movies that all these people remember this. But I remember when I saw The Sixth Sense for the first time, I had no idea. My wife says she's figured it out. And
I loved
it.
Let's not spoil The Sixth Sense for anyone.
No, we're not going to spoil it. But I remember feeling that way and going, oh, my gosh, what a great rush that is in a movie.
Right.
You see it the second time, you still appreciate its construction and everything else. And maybe even one more time is important because then you catch stuff leading up. You're like, oh, there's a sign.
And there you can tell sign. If there. And I'll be honest, with Psycho, there are very few signs.
Yeah.
In fact, there are signs that are almost hard to believe the other way. Like when you see Mom in the window while Norman Bates is coming out of the front door.
Yeah.
If you were on the scent at that point, you would go, well, obviously.
That's two people.
Mom is alive. Sure. There she is. She's sitting up there.
Right. Creepily staring at the thing. But at the end of that, I remember going, oh, man, M. Night Shyamalan, you're the new Hitchcock. You're going to take over, man. You're going to be our modern Hitchcock. And then he was kind of that for a couple more movies, and then he wasn't that anymore. So it kind of bums me out. But I wanted to at least bring up the comparison because it's impossible, I think.
He's making a comeback with Split.
He is, really like Split. Well, it's a comeback. It's also a nice return, right? Because Split is, well, I don't want to spoil that either, but. My favorite movie he made was his second one, and that's all I'll say because it'll give something away. But yeah, like seeing him get back to those roots and not doing, you know, airbender movies and trying to make plants come alive and kill people or whatever or whatever that was. Was that The Happening? That was garbage.
Oh yeah, I was gonna call it the spores.
Yeah. And I really dislike The Village. Like there's a lot
of allergens.
It's like every one of those movies, it was like, hey, I'm going to go all Hitchcock again. And then you go, oh, this isn't even close to your first.
Well, that was the problem with M. Night. I liked all of those movies. I liked The Village. Sure. I had fun with The Village, but you knew a twist was coming, you know, and nothing. So when the twist came, you're like, ah, there it is.
But Hitchcock wasn't so much known for that, was he, though? Like, his movies were, they weren't always.
They didn't always have, like, surprise twists. No. They often did, but not always.
Yeah. And I think that kept it fresh, probably, for consumers of his fine product. I used to like the TV show a lot, the kind of.
Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
That's the one. It would come. He'd come out with the big face logo and stuff.
Funny you should mention that. I think that's one of the most impressive things about Psycho is. The studio didn't want him to make it. They had passed on the rights to the book by Robert Bloch, which, by the way, Psycho is not entirely faithful to the book, but it's based on a story of a guy who would kill young women in a hotel. It was in Wisconsin, wasn't in Arizona or California, but it was based on a real killer who didn't kill as many people as Norman Bates. That's kind of the big departure, but a lot of this. Is definitely straight from Robert Bloch's book. And because the studio didn't want him to make it, he decided to go it alone and use the Alfred Hitchcock Presents crew for this. Mm-hmm. So originally James P. Cavanaugh wrote a screenplay. Hitchcock didn't like it, so he gave it to Joseph Stefano, who actually gets credit for the screenplay. And one can assume they just didn't use any Cavanaugh's work. But they used the cinematographers, they used the crew, and they shot on the sets. This could have gone very wrong. This could have looked like a really bad television show, right? Like a TV movie, and it doesn't. It looks great. It's actually one of the reasons it's in black and white. Most movies were coming out in color by this time, but it was cheaper to do black and white. So he chose black and white, and then how awesome is it? Because it just looks so much cooler.
Oh, it looks way cooler. Like everything. I'm so glad they went black and white. Everything looks cooler in this. And I really liked, I don't know. There's a vibe to it. That's just, it's more than noir. It's something else.
Yeah.
Can't really put my finger on it. Also, this was the first time I noticed or was reminded that this was supposed to be Arizona. And then like outside of Arizona, like that. I don't remember that Phoenix thing at all. People are way too comfortable in full clothing there to be Phoenix. They'd all be dead.
Well, that was one kind of not anachronistic, but a moment that stuck out as of its time when the Texan comes in and is like, you ought to buy your girls some air conditioning. Yeah. And it's like, wow, people worked in Phoenix in the summer without air conditioning. Of course, I guess it's December.
Right.
And that's another little tidbit is they shot the scenes in Phoenix and the town that they were shooting in had Christmas decorations up when they shot the stuff. And so when they got it back, they're like, oh, wait, it says there's like Christmas things on the street. And you see it most prominently when she's driving. And so they decided to say, okay, this happens in December then, because that'll explain that.
I like that kind of stuff when they have to sort of make do because someone screwed up and didn't notice that something was being filmed. So they got to kind of tweak the whole movie to be around it. No one ever thinks of it as a Christmas film, though, in the way they do like Die Hard. Or
yeah,
something.
Why don't they?
I don't know.
Probably because it's black and white. If it had been color and you could see those, you know, Christmas decorations, yeah. And yeah. He doesn't play into it either. The script never acknowledges Christmas is coming, or you don't hear carols in the background or anything like you do in Die Hard.
This is the first. This is a little piece of info I couldn't resist. It is the first American film ever to show a toilet flushing on screen,
right.
Which is crazy. Well, I would have never thought that.
That is another hallmark of Psycho. Hitchcock very often pushed the limits with the censors. The censors were voluntary. It wasn't a government censorship program, but it was the film industry had decided to self-police, and you had a board made up of various figures, some of which from religious institutions or public institutions, and they would decide what could go in a movie or not, what was acceptable or what rating the movie would get anyway. Mm-hmm. And he really pushed the limits with Psycho at a time when restrictions were loosening up. But there's a funny story, and I think it's in the film Hitchcock, they relate this, where he didn't change anything. He showed him the movie, and a couple of the censors said, "We're pretty sure we saw breasts." And he's like, no, everything's covered. I know she's in a bra, but everything's covered.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, let me re-edit. Let me change it up. Didn't touch it, brought it back. The people who thought they'd saw breasts didn't see him anymore, but now two other people did.
I love it.
And then he said, great, you know what? We'll reshoot scenes. Mm-hmm. You guys just show up and we'll reshoot them. And they never showed up, so he didn't reshoot them. And it went into the movie.
That's hilarious. I love that. And no better than him to play that little game.
Yeah.
Like to have them fail their psychology test because Alfred Hitchcock is dinking with them. That's amazing. I had no idea. That's
well,
great.
And not just the toilet, but also an unmarried couple shown in a single bed.
Yeah. Like clearly in the post, I don't want to use the word coitus, but I'll go ahead and say it. And they also, you know, walking around shirtless and with the bra on and all that. I just thought, man, 1960, you guys were, I didn't know you had it in you back then. I guess they totally did.
It was before the summer of love, folks.
Yeah.
Maybe it's what caused it. I don't know.
It's all down to Anthony
Perkins. 8 years later, a bunch of traumatized teenagers who went to see Psycho.
That poor guy, I feel like he's one of the first examples of typecasting in Hollywood. I could have that wrong. I'm
who,
sure
Anthony Perkins?
Yeah. Because it seemed like, I'm sure there were guys in like old noir movies who were always the mobster guys, and that just was their job for the rest of their time. But in the kind of, I don't know, post-50s, studios-owned-everybody kind of world, seemed like he was the first guy to get saddled with something that would just dog him his whole career. He would never not be Norman Bates.
He certainly was a guy. I don't know if he was the first. I think you'd get a lot of arguments about that, but he suffered from that. And he's, I think probably what you're reacting to is he is one of the guys when we were kids in the 80s who was an older character that had been typecast.
Mm-hmm.
And if you saw Anthony Perkins in something, he was Norman Bates.
Yeah.
Kind of didn't matter what they'd cast him in. He was in fact Norman Bates, and everybody looked at him that way. I remember when Psycho 2 came out, and they're like, he's back. He's got out. And I remember that's when I found out about Psycho at all as a movie. Cause I'm like, who is he? They're making a big deal. Like I should know who this guy is. And my parents are like, oh yeah, Psycho. You know,
yeah. This would be for us today. It'd be like if they came out tomorrow with a sequel plans or reboot plans for something like, a brand new Friday the 13th movie. And I know there was one in 2013. So keep your emails to yourselves. I know. But let's just pretend in a vacuum.
Yeah, yeah.
They've let that sit for a really long time. And suddenly there's a sequel or a reboot or a he's back kind of campaign. That's how we would react. And our kids would go, who's back? And then they.
Well, I'd forgotten about this till I was looking at IMDb.
Yeah.
Anthony Perkins was in The Black Hole. Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. With the robots.
I was obsessed with that movie when I was 9 years old, right?
Yeah, I loved it.
He was Dr. Durant.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my parents being like, you know, Anthony Perkins, like, come on, you know, he's Norman Bates. I didn't know who he was. And then when Psycho 2 came out, I'm like, oh, it's that guy from the Black Hole.
The Black Hole. Now, you know, telling my kids about the Black Hole be a struggle because I don't, that thing's not ever streaming anywhere, or they've never been exposed to it, so they wouldn't know what I was talking about. I loved that movie. It was really cool for its time. And it was also really daring for Disney, by the way.
Yeah.
This episode's not about Black Hole, but it bears right. saying it was like a pretty rad thing. So one other thing about Anthony Perkins and his getting stuck with this typecasting. It really bummed me out in this viewing because for whatever reason, I felt like I was being more attentive to everything because we're going to talk about it. And because we're going to talk about it, I feel like I don't want to miss anything. I want all the details. He's really good. Like,
yeah,
genuinely good at this. Like, this is a role that I think in 1960 should net a guy like that a Best Picture nomination at the least, or Best Actor at the least. And I don't know that it did. I haven't looked up what awards it may or may not have been nominated for, but he's really good in it. And it bums me out because I don't know if that was all he ever could do and they hired him on those merits. Sorry, I used your name in vain. But
well, they certainly didn't hire him because of his Johnson.
Oh, that was good. That was worth the whole thing. But you know what I mean? Like, I felt like he could have done something else. He was really, really good in this to the point that I was just completely impressed this watch through. I just thought, oh my gosh.
I hadn't actually thought about this until this viewing, which is probably my fourth. I was trying to remember. It's probably my fourth time seeing it.
Yeah.
And he is disarming, right?
Yeah.
The problem with me seeing Psycho for the first time, I wasn't spoiled on some of it, but I was spoiled on who Norman Bates was. I'm like, oh yeah, I know you're the killer, right? Right. You're the mean, evil guy. I don't know how you do it, but you're evil. Right. But if you don't know that, when she shows up at the motel, he is such an aw shucks, you know, Andy Griffith character.
Sure.
I don't know if you suspect him. It's sort of a misdirection of like, well, this is a creepy motel. Oh, but this guy's so nice.
Right.
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 And so when he looks through the peephole, you're like, oh, he's not so nice after all. But he's so aw shucks, you know, gee, oh, I'm sorry. Can I bring you a sandwich? Well, I don't want to go in your room. That would be disrespectful. You know, and so he goes from that to arguing with his mother and being very meek to the when Arbogast comes and investigates him. He's horrible. Like, he is a bad liar. Mm-hmm. You're like, how did this guy get away with the murders? Because he cannot tell a lie to save himself. Thank goodness it's not the actual police, or they'd probably be pulling him in right now. Because he's so nervous and antisocial. He doesn't really interact with people. Nobody comes to the hotel. He lives with a corpse. Like, he doesn't have anybody to talk to but himself, literally. So that all makes sense. And he's got the nervous habit of eating the candy corn and everything, which apparently Anthony Perkins ad-libbed. That wasn't in the script. He just said, hey, do you mind if I just have candy corn and mess around? And
I'm like, he's really good at that. Like, I bought that whole thing. All of his dialogue when he's being all folksy is just, it feels improv. It feels natural. Like,
I get what I was going for when I said I hadn't thought of it until this viewing. It is somewhat unfortunate to me that we don't get to see him act as his mother.
Oh.
And maybe it was because he couldn't do it, or maybe they just didn't trust the audience to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be what a Johnny Depp, you know, or someone today would sink their teeth into, is being all of those versions of Norman Bates and then in getting a chance at the very end when he's asked for the blanket to be mother.
Yeah,
you know, with the Norman Bates face, but to sound like mother. And they used three different women to do the voices. It was never actually Anthony Perkins' voice when he was talking to his mother, because he really wanted to convince you. But in a world where you can do Orphan Black, I feel like you could have had Anthony Perkins be mother, and that would have vaulted him into an Oscar nomination. I'm pretty sure.
And that brings me to this question about sequels, not sequels, remakes. Sequels are sequels. That's a money grab. I get it. But this reboot Gus Van Sant did was notable because it was shot for shot just like the original Psycho. He was trying to be very true to the original, throw in some modernisms. The shower scene would
keep Hitchcock's vision,
right?
But updated it for, you know, a world with cell phones and the internet.
It's almost like the only time it's the only way he could get away with it, that anyone would let him do this, because if you're not going to be really true to the source, then why are you doing it at all? But at the same time, why are you doing it all if you're going to be so strict to the source? So I'm kind of torn on that, but I've seen that a couple of times, and it's interesting from a just sort of a experiment to go, oh yeah, this is shot for shot, or interesting that this happens here this way, or in color this is so much more impactful, or whatever. And the shower scene's more violent, you know, there's more blood. Like they definitely update it in ways that are less sensor resistant and that sort of thing. But it begged the question, as much as I enjoyed the experiment of seeing that, should a movie like Psycho really ever be remade? Does it ever need to? And I don't know. Like, there's some movies I think would benefit from a remake. I could name a lot of them off the top of my head, but I don't think Psycho is one of them. So it's interesting that A, that it got done, and then B, it was received so poorly. I don't think because it was poorly made, or, you know, they weren't good actors or anything like that. I think it's because they mostly got chewed out for being so careful to stay within the lines of the original Psycho. So I'm curious what you think about all that.
Here's the thing. I have a liberal view of remakes. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think it will be bad for Star Wars to be remade. Mm. Let me just leave that for the screaming from people to happen.
Yeah.
I think with certain properties, there's a period of time that has to happen, right? Yeah. The Jazz Singer was the first talkie, and they remade it with Neil Diamond. But they waited 80 years to do it, right? Well, maybe not quite 80, but they waited a long time. You wait until the audience that really knows the original isn't around anymore, and you're like, okay, you know, let's do it in a way that looks modern and looks cool. And I think in the year, 2105, you could absolutely remake Star Wars, because it's taking a great story and retelling it with modern views. Mm-hmm. Psycho isn't a great story. Mm. What's great about this movie is not that there are so many twists, or that it's a compelling story of a woman with $40,000 in an envelope. What's great about Psycho is the visuals. Mm-hmm. It's the way it's shown to you. Mm-hmm. And that's why they did the shot-for-shot remake. But to me, if all you're doing is a shot-for-shot remake, what are you adding? Like, yeah, you have to add something for the remake to make sense. You have to update it or provide a new perspective or make it work for a modern audience. Psycho works fine for a modern audience. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to update it. Psycho is one of the few movies where I don't think you remake it because, I mean, maybe you remake it in a world that's so far advanced in technology that a 2D black and white movie just doesn't work anymore, because people are like, why isn't this in smell-low surround or whatever? But then you remake it for the format.
Yeah.
You get a Janet Leigh looking actress and you do it in black and white, and you can smell the chocolate sauce when she gets stabbed.
Ugh. It's worse than blood somehow. I don't know why, but
yeah.
All right. So I agree. Of all the movies we've seen for this list so far, I could see remakes of all of them, but this, in other words, I feel like they're all worthy of some new treatment.
Hilariously, this is one that's actually been remade.
Yeah, that's what's so weird about it. It feels sacrosanct, for example, to redo The Godfather. And I'm not saying these are perfect for remakes. I'm just saying of the list we've done so far, I could see that more than I'd see this. Certainly could see Citizen Kane being remade in like a heartbeat. Like, I would love to see a modern retelling of that story. That could be really interesting.
Yeah, with Citizen Kane, what you could do is tell it in a different way. You've got a very compelling story about Charles Foster Kane that you could update. You make him an internet mogul or something, right?
Right.
There's a possibility. I still think it's probably a bad idea. It's certainly a very risky idea, but I see the possibility there.
Yeah.
With Psycho, I'm like, I don't know what you're adding. If you add color, it takes away from it. If all you're doing is having some of the characters have cell phones, you haven't added enough. So you really need to add something new to it to make me feel like it has to be redone. Otherwise, it's great. It's perfect the way it is.
Yeah, kind of totally how I feel about it. You mentioned something earlier that now everything is clicked into place. Universal getting the rights back, starting up sequels. I could not for the life of me figure out. Now, I rented this on Amazon, so this may have something to do with it. Their cut of it or something, I don't know. But I start watching it, and what do I get? I get the modern era 3D Universal logo intro. all in color, just comes out and does the big universal over the Earth.
Right.
Then it fades out, and I expect some now the oldies to start. Nope. I get another universal logo, but it's one from 10, 15 years ago.
Huh.
Don't have any explanation for this, but it rolls in, does a different kind of animation as it comes into place. That stops. Then I get Paramount for a hot second.
The black and white Paramount.
Yeah, for like a hot second. Like, it's barely there, and then the Paramount's out of there. Mount Baldy is out of there, and we're off to the races. And so I found this. It says it was his last film for Paramount, but by the time principal photography started, he'd already moved all of his offices to Universal, and the film was actually shot on Universal's back lot, where, by the way, the house still stands. Mm-hmm. Back there. In fact, I remember
the
seeing
motels it, on the motel, studio or, tour.
Yeah, and I remember when I went back in 85 seeing that and thinking it was freaky, and I didn't know that much about the movie in the first place, but still pretty freaky. Anyway, Universal owns the film today, but Paramount had it for a long time, so I don't know if Paramount's or if Universal's so happy that they decided to put two of their recent logos on it. But I thought that was strange. It's like, why am I seeing Universal twice? It was really weird.
Well, I'll tell you what. I may not remember it. I watched it on Stars.
Yeah.
Because we subscribe to Stars right now. And so it was free. It was just part of the subscription.
Right.
All I remember is the Paramount logo. I don't remember seeing a Universal logo.
Weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows?
But since you're talking about it, I did think it was really odd that the credits being in Helvetica made it feel modern.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially because we've had so many movies kind of copy that 60s style recently, mm-hmm, that these credits felt super current to me.
I'm so glad you brought this up. And it's also great to use the word current on Current Geek. Here's what I was going to tell you that I love about this movie. One of my favorite graphic artists slash designers slash whatever you want to call this guy was Saul Bass. And he is famous for a million movies. Like intros, text, logos, scrolling words, just kind of the treatment to the way graphically a movie might come in or go out. Saul Bass was your guy. That's who you'd hire. And he did this. And that dude was way ahead of his time in 1960. And the use of a Helvetica font would have been super weird back then because you used mostly serifed fonts. This is back to my, I'm going back to my typography 1 and 2 days in college. But you would use serifed fonts, and they'd be often very scripty looking. That was a carryover from the 50s. It was really hard to shake that. And here he comes with a sans serif block font of relatively new Art Nouveau Helvetica. Blew everybody's mind at the time. Like, it would have been a real shocker visually to us today. We're like, oh, we see lots of fonts of different configurations all the time. But I am so glad you brought that up.
And we see Helvetica everywhere.
Yeah, all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Helvetica is the...
The whole documentary about Helvetica.
Literally called Helvetica.
Helvetica.
Yeah. In hell, they have Helvetica. That's how broad the base of Helvetica is.
They just call it Vetica down there.
Right. But even like at the very end, it says the end. And there's the music going. And his cool, stripey kind of effect is happening.
Right.
And that car is being pulled out of the goop. It is so informative to see this in 1960 because that effect of this discordant shapes coming together to form the word psycho. And it's a little off and cracked and not exactly right and not perfectly perpendicular, the parts of the letter and stuff. That would inform this sort of thing for decades. Today, you go see a horror movie today, they don't just come out with frilly logos and stuff. They come out with really weird, whacked out, you know, strange intros. And that Saul Bass guy does not get enough credit. He's great. Go look
him
up.
Tried to take credit for directing the shower scene.
Oh, he did?
Because he did storyboard it. He's got art that he drew of that shower scene.
Oh, wow.
And that's the one where Janet Leigh is like, no, I was there. Hitchcock directed it.
Yeah.
But Saul Bass tried to get more credit for that, I think.
Yeah. He's super, super cool. So I'll say this. If you've seen, let's see, I'll give you a movie. If you've seen all the Hitchcock stuff, chances are you've seen Saul Bass's work. Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho, all that stuff. But
yeah,
he did a lot
amazing.
More than that. He did stuff for the old Casino movie, Cape Fear, the original Cape Fear, Goodfellas. The titles in 1990s, Goodfellas, where Saul Bass directed. Like, that guy is the man. So I wanted to give him credit where it's due. So there you
this
go.
Is probably one of those things that you'll hear us say every one of these episodes, at least when we're doing older films. But it always just stuns me, first of all, to have all the credits done up front.
Yeah.
right? Yeah. When they start showing art design and cinematography, I'm like, oh, wow, okay, we're doing this. We're doing it all at the beginning,
yep.
Which was still done in 1960. But the best part was special effects by Clarence Champagne. And I'm like, boy, that's a lot longer now.
Yeah.
And according to IMDb, there's two other people, Walter Hammond and Don Wolves, who also were uncredited for special effects, which also is a current problem sometimes.
Sure.
But yeah, instead of the minutes long scroll of every rotoscoper who worked on you know, certain panels.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah. Like today you go see a movie and it's just like miles of people who were, and from different companies and organizations, and this one was a character animator. This guy did the background, blah, blah, blah. Here's Matt Painter.
They outsourced the coloring to Lucasfilm, mm-hmm. or Industrial Light Magic. And so then you got all the whole team that worked on that on there.
Yeah, that's I like that kind of stuff.
No, it's cool.
Did you ever see, it's a documentary. Dang it, I was going to have this ready for the show. Crap, I don't have it. I'll try to find it before we're done. There's a great documentary that I want to recommend to people. It came out, and it's old though. It's like, oh, here it is. This is the one. This is newer. I thought it was older. I
can't wait to hear what it is.
Sorry, it's called 7852 is the name of the documentary, and I thought that meant it was made in 78. So this is all news to me. But this came, was being talked about at Sundance. This all makes sense that it's new now because it was happening at Sundance this week or last week.
Oh, okay. So this is brand new.
Yeah, it's a documentary all about the shower scene in Psycho.
Oh.
And I don't know if you can get it anywhere, but they interview people like Del Toro, Jamie Lee Curtis, Eli Roth, Oz Perkins, like Danny Elfman, Elijah Wood, a bunch of weird actors talking about the scene, that its impact, what it meant for people. The 7852 has something to do with millimeters and lenses and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they used a... I can't remember what the actual aspect ratio is. Maybe you can find that real quick. But they used a 50 millimeter lens on a 35 millimeter camera, mm-hmm. which ends up mimicking normal human vision. So it really immerses you in that scene.
Yeah, it's right here, actually. There it was. Where did it go? I just saw it. Lens. There's a lot of stuff about how $40,000 would be $350,000 now, which is... kind of awesome.
He shot this for nothing.
Yeah.
Like he paid for it. And it ended up being incredible.
Lens. I can't find it. Oh, here it is. For a shot right with the water stream. Oh, this may not be it. But he had a 6-foot diameter shower head made up so that the water sprayed past the camera and didn't get it wet. That's not the reference I was thinking.
Yeah, they blocked the center holes of the shower head. And then they positioned the camera just so that the water sprayed out enough that it didn't hit the camera, but you couldn't really tell. Yeah. It looks like you're just staring up into the water and getting hit yourself.
I do want to call bullcrap on that scene for one tiny thing that is just it's not about this movie. It's about anybody who gets into a shower. And the first thing they do is they disrobe, they get in, and you just turn the water on? Nope. Nobody does that. You don't just get hit with the first blast. It's going to be freezing cold. Are you kidding me? You never do that.
Nope.
Unless you're into that, like you want to get shocked out of your mind.
Hold on. She's from Phoenix. Maybe she's that hot and sweaty.
Yeah.
You know, no air conditioning in that car. Maybe.
Could be.
I don't know.
Could be. Who knows? Anyway, I wrote here twice. No one starts a shower like that. And then later.
No one starts a shower either.
I said, you have to run it first.
Ah.
I was insistent.
78 shots and 52 cuts.
Oh, that's what it is. It's not about lenses. That's not it. Yeah.
Yep.
That's getting all kinds of raves out of the Sundance Film Festival here in Park City, and people are flipping out about it. So it's nice timing with us talking about this. Perhaps you
can good for them.
Go find that. Yeah.
Way to sync up with our schedule.
Yeah, well done, Sundance. Guys. Real well done. Also, let's see. I had a question about... Janet Leigh.
Yes, that was going to be my next thing too.
Yeah, well, she's great in this.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I've ever seen a single other thing with her ever. Did she end up with the same problem? She didn't get typecast, did she? Or how'd this go?
This is the famous movie. If you've ever seen it parodied, you've probably seen it parodied of "No one will be seated after the opening credits have rolled."
Mm-hmm.
Hitchcock did that. He got the, and by the way, Paramount was the distributor, even though Universal produced it. That's why that whole Universal Paramount thing. He got Paramount to agree and got the theaters to agree to do this because he felt like if people came in late and Janet Leigh got murdered right as they were sitting down, that they'd feel ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're like, wait a minute, she's the big star, and I didn't even get to see her. So that was part of it. Also, he didn't want people to get spoiled on the twists. He wanted people to see it right from the beginning and have it all built up and have them misdirected by the money and all of that. Right. But yeah, Janet Leigh was a solid star. Her first movie was in 1947. She did movies like The Red Danube, Holiday Affair, Angels in the Outfield, not the 80s, 90s one, but the 1952 one.
Sure.
Or 1951. She did like 20 or 30 movies. Prince Valiant. You know, she was in the Schlitz Playhouse on TV.
The Schlitz Playhouse.
Yeah. Who doesn't love the Schlitz Playhouse? And then Psycho in 1960. So she's a star.
Yeah.
She's not a top star, but she's a star. And then she does Psycho. And then she does Manchurian Candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And then she does Bye Bye Birdie. And those are kind of the three big ones for her. And Psycho was the first of those.
And she'll go on to do other, you know, she's in a
episode. Fantasy Island, Love Boat.
Oh, yeah, all those things for sure. She was in Murder, She Wrote.
This TV series Starman.
Oh, I like, actually, I kind of like Starman. I like the movie and I also kind of like the TV attempt, but it didn't last for.
And this isn't that recent, but she worked right up until 2005. She was in Bad Girls from Valley High as Mrs. Witt.
Yeah. I remember her from Halloween H2O, the 20 years later thing. She played somebody named Norma. There was a big deal made about her cameo in that. And she
she died in 2004, so I guess she didn't work till 2005, but the movie came out.
Yeah, it's that happens. But Murder, She Wrote, her episode was called Doom with a View. That's pretty good, right? I don't get that. It gets you thinking. That gets you going there.
Yeah. Although Room of the View is not starring Janet Leigh.
No, it's not. That's the other funny thing. I mean, it's a weird disconnected reference for her, but it makes me laugh.
But yeah, I wondered, I mean, Janet Leigh, obviously game, right? She's like, oh, sure, I'll do shots in my bra. I'll get paid to be in a movie that only has me in it for 20 minutes before I get killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll have this weird shower scene that will be iconic and you'll barely see me in. So,
yeah,
you know, pretty adaptable as an actor, especially for 1960. I feel like.
She was so memorable in this. And I think part of it is the, we talk about it's low on plot, but it's great on ideas, this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great ideas is having the audience think the protagonist they're following is going to make it all the way through somehow. That's just a given in 1960, especially. And I would say that this movie probably paved the way for lots of weird ideas moving forward. But there were no movies where the person you establish in the beginning, who may be a little flawed, she stole some money, she's doing it for forbidden love, all this other stuff. But there's usually a path back. And it usually comes from, oh, I guess she's got to fend off Anthony Perkins or whatever. But this is a case where they killed her.
The movie poster shows Janet Leigh dead center, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pun not intended, you know, in her bra,
yeah.
You know, sitting there looking all sexy. And it is a, you know, starring Anthony Perkins, Vera Miles, John Gavin with Janet Leigh. Like her name is as big as Vera Miles and Gavin and Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have been a giveaway that it's with Janet Leigh on the poster. Maybe that should have tipped you off. But
right. Well, I mean, Anthony Perkins didn't even show up till about 27 minutes in. He's the first bill on the thing. He's first billed.
Yeah.
Second billed was Vera Miles. She doesn't show up till 57 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
So poor, you know, what's her name? Hanging out in the beginning, doing all the hard work. And then she gets, and with Janet Leigh at the end, which seemed a little bit of a bummer, but whatever. She has since passed. She had a nice long life. And I found her to be riveting in this third watching. It's the third time I've seen this. And I thought she was great.
Also, a little tidbit. Patricia Hitchcock is Caroline, the sort of slightly annoying office worker.
Is that his wife, daughter, something?
Daughter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know there was family in this.
Also, I love that line where she says, he was flirting with you. Must have seen my wedding ring.
Nice. Didn't she also, or didn't he, he made a cameo himself, but I didn't see it.
Oh yeah. He always makes a cameo. He's in the window. He's out on the street. So it's really early on, and it's really subtle, because at that point everybody looked for the Hitchcock cameo, so they kind of like Stan Lee, and so he's like, let's just get this out of the way early in the movie so people aren't thinking about it.
Yeah, I also really like the cop. I wanted to mention him. He is in lots of movies, including Spartacus and a bunch of other stuff. That guy was getting all over the place.
The sheriff, you mean?
The sheriff, yeah. I say cop. Yeah, yeah. The sheriff. His name was
John McIntyre.
There it is.
Sheriff
John
Al Chambers.
McIntyre. And he died in 91 at the age of 83. He was born in 1907, this guy. Anyway, the minute you see him, you're like, oh, yeah, that guy. He was in Turner and Hooch. Did voice work for a bunch of Disney movies and was.
Well, it's funny is as soon as he came on screen this time, I was like, "Oh, this is gonna be Scott's favorite character." I could just tell.
Totally, there's something about him. I don't know what it was. In fact, I used that for tonight's tweet to let people know we were live. I just couldn't help it because there's something about him. It's pretty cool. In fact, his last movie was Turner and Hooch. Before that, did some other fun stuff that I remember from the '80s, like an episode of St. Elsewhere, The Love Boat. Different Strokes, Night Court.
Everybody in this from this era ended up on The Love Boat, it feels like.
And I want to say he was on MASH once. Let me see if I have that right. No, it's, I may think of somebody else, but he is of that generation. There's a whole bunch of actors that we as kids know from our parents' TV shows that are recognizable immediately. And as soon as I saw him pull up to the car, I went, all right, here we go. That guy. Let's get it going there, buddy. I have some clips from this movie I'm going to play for you. You want to hear these?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. We haven't gotten any clips yet. We're almost done.
I'll play you a couple of these before we get out of here. Here's something about being thirsty.
Lowry, I am dying of thirst-a-rooney.
Have you ever in your life said you're dying of thirst-a-rooney? It's terrible. It's terrible.
Yeah, never said before, never said since.
I couldn't help but record that guy. He said this also about Las Vegas.
Well, what you need is a weekend in Las Vegas, the playground of the world.
I'm going to spend this weekend in bed. Thank you.
Yeah, really, I'm just
I'm like, with a modern sensibility, her response would have just fed him in his flirting. Like, well, that could be fun too, or whatever, right? Totally. Like, in bed. But instead, it's like, oh, because you have a headache.
Yeah. Right. I hate the Texas oil man stereotype. Not a fan of it. Drives me crazy. Unless it's a cartoon, then I'm into it.
Well, and this guy, you know, he obviously went out and had a Mad Men lunch. And the bank president didn't, you know, he's still very sober, but he's entertaining his client because he wants that $40,000.
Yeah. I recorded this next one because I don't think,
not bank man, real estate.
Real estate man. Yeah. I recorded this next because I don't think this is how car trades work, but I'll play it. And you tell me.
Can I trade my car in and take another?
Do anything you've a mind to. Being a woman, you will. That yours?
Yes. It's, there's nothing wrong with it. I just.
Sick of the sight of it.
So. Can you just go in and say,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. I mean, he makes sure she has the pink slip.
That's
right?
True. And she has the money for the over.
Yeah.
I just didn't think you could. I mean, today, can I do this?
Sure.
Really?
You can do anything you have a mind to. Being a man, you will.
Yeah, that's right. The gender bit was a little, it's 1960. Yeah. Whatever.
No, I mean, sure. Is the salesman oversimplifying it? Yes. And the movie does too. She can trade it in, no problem. There's going to be a little, even in 1960, there's going to be a little more paperwork than they show.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's actually how we got Eileen's car. We went in, we saw it on the lot. We're like, yeah, we'd like to trade in today. And they're like, great. Sign here. We'll run a credit check because we were financing. She's not even financing. So they skipped that part, right? Yeah, she's just going to pay cash.
I guess the 700 seemed low, but it's 1960, so that's probably a few grand.
Well, and it's two used cars in 1960, so yeah.
Sure. All right, here's, what's this? Oh, this is not it. What is this?
Please, Mother.
No, I will not hide in the fruit cellar.
Oh, I just like that line. I don't know why.
There's something hilarious about it once you know it's actually him.
Yeah. Yeah, because imagine him in that room with her clothes on, just talking to himself like Gollum in a room.
I won't hide in the fruit cellar. Yes, you will, Mom. No, I won't.
It would have been so much better if it was really his voice. I would laugh my head off.
Jeanette Nolan did most of the Norma Bates voicing.
Oh.
Paul Jasmine also did some of it. And Virginia Gregg. Those were the three people.
Why'd they need three people, I wonder?
Well, they changed up some of the screams. At one point, they wanted the yelling to sound manic.
Yeah. I'll tell you what they didn't have back then. Microphones that wouldn't like split in half when a lady would scream into them. Good gosh. I hate old movies where there's a scream because I didn't capture it. So I'm not going to ruin your life with it here.
No need to put us through that.
Woo, it's really bad. All right. Final clip. This is the longest one and it's, I'll just play it. Here you go.
It's sad when a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son. But I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have, years ago. He was always bad. And in the end, he intended to tell them I killed those girls and that man. As if I could do anything except just sit and stare, like one of his stuffed birds.
Ugh, creepy.
Because she's a corpse. A little, it does cause a disconnect for me that we have this long exposition from the psychologist about how he's both mother and Norman Bates now. And mother is the one, he hammers home. Mother is the one who killed, and mother's the only one talking to me. And that's how I know mother did this. And then we cut to mother going, oh, I didn't do it.
Right. Exactly. It's very odd. Also, I don't think his psychology explanation for what was going on is even remotely close to what would hold up in court today. Like, that was kind of ridiculous. I mean, you could say innocent or guilty by insanity or whatever the plea is.
By reason of insanity. Yeah.
You could do that.
Not guilty.
You could do that. It's a hard call, but you could do it. But I don't think that guy would be a very good testimony giver as an expert.
I don't know. I mean, some of what he says is very dated. I think the best example is when one of them says he's a transvestite. And he said, no. And I'm like, oh, good. Yeah, no, he's not a transvestite. He doesn't do it for sexual pleasure. I'm like, well, neither do all transvestites. Like, that's, you almost did it right.
And then almost did it, buddy. Anyway. And that guy, by the way, is in a ton of old stuff. Like Charlie's Angels, Vegas, Maverick, The Rockford Files, all kinds of cool stuff. You know him, Kojak. Oh, man, yeah, that dude's been around. So I like him, but I didn't buy his deal. But that's fine. He's not the important part of the movie. But anyway.
It is weird that we finished on a long exposition in a movie that is so visually satisfying.
Yeah, well, it's almost just because, I mean, honestly, there's not a ton of audio in this thing. The whole bits from the shower scene forward, a lot of really quiet stuff. He's cleaning.
Yeah.
He's setting things up.
I mean, there's audio, mm-hmm. but it's not speaking.
Yeah.
And it's not loud always.
Which, again, even in this viewing, feels like Hitchcock was really stretching some new ideas at the time that we all take for granted now in a million other kind of movies we see. You know, you see a movie like Old Munchie for Cold Men. No Country for Old Men.
They're doing pot in California, Old Munchies.
No Munchie for Cold Men. I'm going to have to remember that. I love that movie, but part of what I love about that movie is it has no soundtrack. It's just the actors. It's just the ambient noise, and there is something really powerful in that. But I think it owes some of it to this. Like, this is a movie there's nothing else in 1960 like this. And I think that's maybe why it's remembered so.
Yeah, it's groundbreaking.
Yeah, it's really good.
For sure. And that's why it's high up on so many of these lists.
Yep, and it made our fourth slot. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. Or is it our fifth? Fifth?
Our fifth is going to be Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, all right.
I promise we'll get to a color movie again. I realized today, like Psycho could have been color, but he shot it in black and white because the reasons we talked about. And we're going to do Sunset Boulevard, which is black and white. There are other color movies than The Godfather in existence. We will watch them. But Sunset Boulevard's next. And we'll be doing that on February 23rd. A little scheduling juggling that made us do this one at the beginning of February instead of the end of January.
Right.
But then we'll kind of be back on track to do them at the end of each month.
Yep, absolutely. So that's coming up. William Holden, Gloria Swanson, directed by Billy Wilder, also written by Billy Wilder. I've never seen it, so this would be one of those where...
Oh, cool. Yeah. No, this is actually... I used to have this one on VHS. This is a good movie.
Oh, nice. Look at you. A teenager with Sunset Boulevard on VHS. You are.
I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille, is a famous line from this movie.
Is that the movie? I didn't know that. Okay. All right. I mean, I know that. I know of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And this
that
is
comes
what?
From Sunset Boulevard.
Year is 1950. So we're jumping back 10 years.
Maybe I'll go drive over to Sunset Boulevard and do the show.
Okay. I like this idea a lot. Right, you're right there. Why not?
Yeah.
That's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for being here. We'll be back next week with a regular show, guests and all that stuff. We really enjoy these movie episodes. We know that you guys seem to as well. We're getting lots of great feedback about it. If this is something you enjoy and you want to hear more of it, or you just like supporting the show in general, head on over to patreon.com/currentgeek. That's patreon.com/currentgeek and show your love for the show that way. It's a great way to kind of support what we're doing, and we really appreciate it. Tom, Merritt, anything else you want to mention before we go?
Keep on checking out my books at TomMerrittBooks.com. The latest one is Pavaria, but there's also Pilot X there, a dog detective book called A Series of Unfortunate Events. No, it's not called that. What do we-
A Series of Unfortunate Events by Tom Merritt.
I'm blanking on the name of my own book, but it's there. It's about dogs and they solve crimes. You'll find it. Enjoy. TomMerrittBooks.com.
That's fantastic. Thank you all for being here. CurrentGeek.com for everything else. Check it out. We'll see you next week, everyone.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review what has become a trend in sending demand or cease and desist letters, a softer edge that is just as much marketing as it is legal. A couple months back, the main show in this segment covered a story about Netflix attorneys sending a cease and desist letter to a pop-up Stranger Things-themed bar with a lot of humor and in-jokes from the show mixed in, instead of the usual threats and legalese. This softer approach is becoming more prevalent, as evidenced by a town crier sent by Budweiser to another brewing company in Minneapolis last month.
Hear ye! Hear ye! Congratulations on the launch of your new brew, Dilly Dilly Mosaic Double IPA. Let it be known that we believe that any beer that is shared between friends is a fine beer indeed, and we are duly flattered by your loyal tribute. However, Dilly Dilly is the motto of our realm, so we humbly ask that you keep this to a limited edition, one-time-only run.
Turns out, even Dilly Dilly can be made into something funny and enjoyable in this context. As with the Stranger Things letter, this town crier demand went viral online and in news coverage, with positive press happening for Budweiser rather than the negative feedback the public often gives when brands are pushy about enforcing their rights. Plus, the Minnesota Brewing Company agreed to comply with the demand and stop selling the Dilly Dilly Mosaic Double IPA after the initial run was sold. Other examples recently of this trend include TGI Fridays sending a box of buttons and other flair to a Chicago bar with a letter asking that the bar's plans to hold an event mimicking the Fridays restaurant be limited to a one-time thing. That certainly made it easier for the bar's employees to look like Friday's servers for this event, and it struck a good balance between enforcing a trademark, which is required to keep those rights, and being reasonable about fan service or parody in this case. In another example, Dole responded to an Instagram meme from a New York branding agency using their company logo for a Halloween joke about receiving bags of fruit instead of candy, but not with a takedown notice. Instead, Dole added to the meme by making some more small bags of fruit and asked that the other company refrain from future unauthorized use of their trademarks so that they didn't have to come, quote, take all their candy away. This trend for demand letters is certainly a response to the negative feedback other companies have gotten on social media and in the news for facing down fans with formal legal threats. This is a smart way to jam some positive marketing into legal responsibilities. Considering that nobody really wants to add more costly litigation to their docket, this softer approach has proven to be effective enough to protect most brands while avoiding legal escalation and bad press. In other words, a win-win. The bottom line is, the old adage of you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar appears to be working in this context. In my own practice, I often recommend a softer edge from content creators and brand owners at the beginning, as it can't hurt to try being somewhat nice before escalating to full conflict. You just might end up with more friends and business partners that way, too. In a society divided by politics and a lot of other stresses, it should come as no surprise that this approach is more effective. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.